curtain call
for the next episode of the Perspectives on Performance podcast with Dr. Louise Marler. Louise interviews a cavalcade of fellow performers from all walks in this must-listen series for anyone wanting to enhance their presence or profile. Here's Louise.
Well, I am incredibly honoured to be here with Cassidy Anderson, otherwise known as Cassie Le Creme. And Cassie is world famous, let me say, with 7 million views on your videos.
Yes.
7 million views on your videos.
It's actually at 9.5 now.
No, 9.5.
Yep, I just checked it last night. We've had a viral video recently, so yes, very fortunate. Very fortunate.
So, Cassie is Australia's Lady Gaga. Lady Gaga, always something different, doing something fabulous, dressed incredibly, looking fabulous. You do music videos, you do film, you've been a magician's assistant, you're a cabaret singer, all of these fantastic skills of performance.
Yeah.
And we're here with the POP podcast to talk about performance and what you do and how people can be aware of what performers actually do to engage with others.
Sure, absolutely. What an introduction.
So
I feel very honoured to be here. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about you.
Okay, so I guess I got my start. I always grew up performing. My mother was a singer. My father's a stunt coordinator.
What sort of singer?
I started with opera when I was 11. Yeah.
What did your mother do?
My mother was classical and jazz.
Oh, wow.
And then she went into an ABBA cover band. And then I stopped singing when I was about 15 or 16 because I had some stage anxiety issues, which we can get into. Yes. And then I fell back into it later when I was performing at Warner Brothers Movie World as Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, how fabulous.
And then that took me on a journey overseas to Universal Studios Singapore. And then I stumbled across the Malay world and a by chance viral video sent me into a whole new career path, and I became a celebrity in Malaysia, Singapore, Brunei for singing in Malay.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you speak Malaysian. You've learned Malaysian.
Now I do, yes. When I first got famous, I didn't speak a word. I just mimicked it through opera skills where you have to sing in alternative languages.
See, the interesting thing is, in opera, I've sung in, I don't know, 15, 20 different languages.
Yes.
And you have a coach, but there are different ways that you move your mouth.
Absolutely.
You learn word for word. You learn overall meaning, you know.
Yes.
And you get to know. So if I went to Italy, you know, I have a lot of lines like, I love you always, your tiny hand is frozen, you know, all of these useless things. But I've got quite a lot of it. But people think that they can't change their voice. Mm. They can't change their accent.
Yes.
And you can. So when you speak Malaysian, do you speak differently?
100%. Even if I speak with Malaysians in English, I speak with a different accent, different inflection, because you learn to mimic. That's what opera taught me, is how to mimic. You don't necessarily understand everything, but you mimic, and it becomes second nature. So I totally understand.
And in Malaysian, do you have that, you know, what Astil calls a tilted larynx, where you are speaking like that?
Yes.
Absolutely.
You get very high and very, I would almost say my voice becomes a bit submissive and very excited and happy and gentle and non-threatening. It's very different to in Australia. We're like, yeah, nah, it's cool. You know, you just sit a lot further back, a lot more relaxed.
Yeah.
It's very different. It's something that when someone tells you to tilt your larynx, you think, oh, that'll sound ridiculous. But when you're in a different environment, it can come naturally and you can learn it.
See, I find people who, say, spoken in an Asian language and they've had a tilted larynx, so they have been speaking like that.
Yes.
And then when they come to speak English, they find it difficult to flatten the larynx and bring it down to a spoken voice. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with that is that when you don't bring the larynx down, you actually can't be heard. You can't put volume onto the voice. So, you know, that's a challenge, and it's totally possible that you do it all the time.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's 100% true, because I do find that in Asian countries it is a lot harder to hear people. So you tend to be asking, what was that? a lot of the time because there's not much projection, because it's not customary to take up that presence in their cultures, whereas in Australia we're a lot more staunch in our approach to things, I think.
Great.
Yeah.
Now, you've just done a movie which is like Underbelly in Australia, except Malaysian.
Yes, it was. So it's called KL Gangster. When I first got into the Malay scene, I was like admired. It was already a movie sort of franchise, and I got invited to do that, and that was my first ever acting role. And we basically created the character. There's a lot of Marilyn Monroe influence in what I do. Right. So, yeah, I got to be a gangster. I got to shoot guns, have a fight scene.
What was it like shooting guns?
Very interesting, a little bit confronting. I guess the safety procedures over there are not what we're used to here in Australia. So you're like, please make sure that nothing can go wrong. Doing a fight scene with a woman swinging an actual sword at you that was metal was rather crazy.
No.
And I broke my entire fingernail off in the process. It was like otherworldly. I'm so grateful for it, though. It was so cool.
That's like Joanna Lumley traveling the Silk Road, and she said, I'm a little bit worried about their health and safety concerns, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's a little bit of a different world. My father's a stunt coordinator, so he was definitely laughing at his daughter ending up in this field.
Yeah. Have you ever done stunts?
Never.
No. I actually once got invited to do stunts, and they had all of this list of things you had to do, which is swim, ride a horse, you know, all of these things that these Australians can do, so they love Australians.
Yeah.
But then the last things you had to tick off, one was jump off a cliff with no parachute, you know, and tightrope across between tall buildings. I'm like, no.
You're like, there's a line somewhere. I'm the same way. I was born with a natural fear of death, unlike my father. So, this was a new experience for me in stunts, but another area of performing.
Yeah. So tell me about how you do what you do, because you play different characters.
Yes.
And Marilyn Monroe's been a big one.
Yeah, definitely.
What's it like being Marilyn Monroe?
Amazing. It's always a really great experience. It is something that I was sort of told I was going to do from a child because of the pale skin, the blue eyes, just my appearance. Everyone always used to say, well, you would make an amazing Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, wow.
And then it sort of ended up falling into doing it. But for me, I was never trained as an actor.
No.
So I just had to sort of mimic what she did and sink or swim.
Was it boring doing that all day?
Sometimes yes, if I'm completely honest, because I did it for probably 7 years full time in taking photos. When there was a show to do, never boring. But it was very interesting being a performer, and people feel like because you're a character, you're not a human, so they can treat you however they like and say what they want to you.
Right.
So it's a very different experience being in that character and having to stay in that character. And it's great because you learn how to react to something in a way that you wouldn't normally, but you have to think, how would someone else? And then you sort of learn it by osmosis.
What sort of mannerisms does Marilyn do?
Her posture is completely different to mine.
Okay.
So when I have heels on, I tend to walk differently to her. And then I sort of taught myself to do it. And then when I moved up in the ranks and went to Universal Singapore, I had to teach people to do it. And I realized there is a lot of methodology. She speaks a certain way. She has facial mannerisms that I had to learn. Her eyes are always sort of half closed. She's a little bit breathy, a little bit giddy, a lot higher voice than I have. So it would be like, oh, hello, daddy. You know, it was just like this whole body movement when she talks, as opposed to me, who's quite chill in Australia. So many little tricks of the trade there, that's for sure.
And did I see that you're doing makeup classes?
I have taught a few in my time. I've done some makeup workshops, and I've also recently been mentoring a few speakers, public speakers and coaches on personal appearance.
Yep.
So that's something that carries over.
You'd be surprised how little people know about makeup. And somebody asked me just last week, and I'm going, they said, who does your hair and makeup? That probably looks dreadful, but you know.
Not at all. No, you definitely know how to do yours. You're exactly right.
What do you think?
It is something that we all either have an interest in or we don't. We've been exposed to it or we haven't.
Yeah.
And if you haven't, it just means you've got to go out and learn it.
Which comes down to all a matter of skill.
Yes.
So when I'm fascinated, you did a little stint as a magician's assistant in Germany. So how do you make an entrance as a magician's assistant? What do you think about?
I was taught it is regal.
Yeah.
So everything, when you see a circus performer, they'll basically go, and go. It's like a jumping off a cliff.
I love that, the way you opened up.
It is, it's open.
Because many people go, and go. And they close down. It's got to be open.
Yes, absolutely. It is about projecting out and commanding attention.
See, so the minute you start doing that, your eyes go out there. So where do your eyes go?
Yeah. Always up and out towards the back. Whereas when you're self-conscious, it's down and low to the floor.
Are you aware of ever glimpsing down just before you go on? Because it's a habit that I find many people do.
Yes.
Just before they go on, they look down. And I say, no, never look down. Mm. Look up, up.
I'm trying to think through my performances now. Mm. I do a lot of techniques before I go on stage. I think I definitely would look down, but I do a lot of closed eye work within myself to sort of rid myself of anxiety. Mm. So, I definitely think I would.
So you said you had performance anxiety, or you got at the age of 15, 16. Was there a specific incident that happened?
Yes, definitely. I stopped singing for about 5 to 6 years because when men grow up, they obviously have their voice breaks.
Yeah.
But you don't realize that women have vocal change as well. And so I was getting very apparent breaks in my singing voice, not in my speaking voice. Right. And I had one performance. It was at a Stedford on the Gold Coast.
Right, there
you go. There we go. My voice broke 3 times and I was mortified in one song. And I ran out of there crying. I was like,
what was
the
song?
Sing again. It was a Kelly Clarkson song called Beautiful Disaster.
And who was there? Do you remember who was there, what time of day it was, what the light was in the room?
Yes, absolutely.
Who was beside you, who was in front of you? All that definition of a crisis situation, psychological crisis.
Yes.
And then from there, what happened?
I didn't sing again for many years, and I always had a very small, meek, little soprano voice. I was a lyric soprano, and I was told, you'll never sing big, belty songs. You've just got a little voice, and now I sing massive, belty rock songs, and it was a lot to do with my confidence and letting go of anxiety. So for me, on that day, I was like, I'll never sing again. A few years later, when people sort of heard that I was a trained singer, they forced me to learn to sing for the Marilyn audition. That got me back into it, and eventually it was just a lot of things that I had to learn to overcome that anxiety, and people pushed me in the deep end.
Right, and then you had a lot of positive experiences.
Yes.
Which then rebuilt
the
confidence.
Until I started singing in Malay. Then because for me it was instant fame, there was far too much pressure.
Right.
So all my confidence crumbled again because then you're singing in another language. So when you're singing in another language, you can't, I'm sure you would have experienced, if you mess up one word, it's very hard to cover. If in English, you know the language enough to dance around that topic till you get back to where you were. So that was super confronting for me. So I had to seek training on this.
Yeah, what did you do?
I sought a teacher that could help me with the pre-nodules I was experiencing from all the stress and tension.
So that means the vocal folds had swollen up and you kept working on them, a little bit like walking in high heels with just one point. You know, it's like the vocal folds only hit one point, and then they swell up. And if they keep hitting on that one point, they swell, and that's called pre-nodular swelling. And then if they keep doing it, that you actually form scar tissue on that point, and then that's nodules. When the vocal folds don't swell anymore and they go down, the scar tissue's still there and they're nodules.
Right.
And that's the problem. And the vocal folds will no longer stretch and go short, which is what they need to do for high notes and low notes.
Yes.
Because they've got scar tissue and it just gets lasered off. But you never got nodules. You got pre-nodular swelling.
Yes, I got pre-nodular swelling. I was very fortunate to get on top of it quickly because I was losing my voice a lot. It was horrible.
Yeah.
So that adds to the stress, of course. But I was fortunate enough to meet a man called Gerald Marco, who is here in Melbourne, and he actually is a Reiki master.
Reiki.
And so when I went to him, I was actually doing shows, flying over and doing things for like the government in Malaysia And he was like, your singing technique's not the problem. It's your stage anxiety. And
right.
So he gave me a lot of breathing techniques.
Right, put your breath down.
Breath down and calming my nervous system before going on stage. It's the same as doing a speaking event. If you don't have the tools to get you in the right mindset before you go on stage, of course you're going to be...
So what are the tools? Amanda Gorman at the inauguration, she
yes.
was saying that she has a mantra before she goes on.
Right.
And that's very common. Do you
yeah.
have a mantra?
I don't have a specific mantra, but I definitely say to myself, I remind myself that it's almost like you belong on this stage. Like people
okay,
want
yes.
to hear what you have to say. People want to see you perform. And the most powerful, I guess, analogy and headspace I try to get myself into is I was finding when I stepped on stage, you could sense in my energy, I didn't want people to look at me. I wanted to hide away. And you can see the body language is already going. Now I'm aware of it. But I was definitely very aware of that. Almost fear of people seeing me because I also didn't want to be a show-off. And he gave me the realization that when you're on stage, you're supposed to be in your element. You're welcoming them into your show. You're giving a show and they're coming into your world. And so he gave me some exercises. If you want, I can show you
yeah,
one of them.
Okay.
So one of them was actually an exercise that he would say, if you can get into the space before you have to perform, you get yourself, you can sit on the stage,
yep.
Say if you're going for a sound check. You sound
so
a bit weird doing it.
This is context specific, is get up on the stage.
Yes.
So, you know, a technique that people will often
mm-hmm.
use is in the break or in the morning
yes.
or the evening, you find the stage and you walk on it because
mm.
you get the feeling of the perspective.
Yes.
Because if you get up there for the first time and you're getting that perspective for the first time, that can be quite shocking.
It can
and you
be.
Don't want any of those shocks.
Yes,
yeah.
And when you're visualizing, you can visualize the room all you want, but you don't know how it feels till you're standing
yeah,
on that stage.
That's right. So you get up there. Right?
Absolutely. You get up there. If you can't get up there, at least get in the room
yeah.
and visualize, know the direction you'll be looking at, and either do it sitting on the stage to the side or even behind the stage, just close your
yeah.
eyes. He basically says, if you imagine this corner of the room, there's a bungee cord to your shoulder.
Right.
That corner of the room, there's a bungee cord. And you want one from all 8 points of connection.
Okay, great.
So with each one you reach, and then you just keep your eyes closed and you lean a little bit into that connection.
Mm-hmm.
And et cetera. You do that for all 8 points, especially if you're going to be wearing heels. Do it in your heels, standing.
That's right, in the right shoes.
Yes, and you open your eyes and you are 100% grounded in the space and you're no longer apologizing for taking up space in that room. And it's amazing. Just taking that moment also calms your nervous system and picturing white light around yourself.
Mm.
That, for me, was a game changer because
right.
we had to get out of cars there, and then you've got 37,000 people grabbing at you from different directions trying to get your attention, and you're walking to the stage. You can't possibly calm your nervous system. So I remember the first time I tried it was in a van on the way to a show. We had people like bashing on the windows trying to get into our van, and I just stopped and just took a few minutes to breathe and just imagined the cone of white light that he suggested. And by the time I opened my eyes, it was like everything sort of went 3 beats slower. It was like, hi, how are you? Got back up onto the stage, and suddenly, because I took that time, I remembered my lyrics. And I like could make eye contact with people in the audience. It just
yeah.
changed my whole
yeah, I love that.
Experience.
So you mentioned that eye contact.
Yes.
I can tell if things go well or don't go well.
Mm.
I've either made eye contact with people and I can remember who was in the audience.
Yes.
Or they're a glaze. And if they're a glaze, that's a bad sign.
That's
a bad
yeah,
sign.
Yeah, because you weren't in the moment.
I force myself to look into people's eyes
yeah.
and grab people because that's that, I guess, one of those ropes, you know, of connection.
Yes.
You know, so you're not separate to that.
Mm. Do you find that the same, I guess, tools that you personally use on stage for performing come in with your speaking as well? Like you can, I always say that it's very similar, whether you're singing on stage, acting, whatever, it is an art of connecting with people. Do you find the same thing with your singing performance as opposed to now that you're speaking and training people?
Yeah, well, it's fascinating because you build up skills over time in a performance
yeah.
background
mm.
and you don't often know what those skills are because in the training of that kind of world, You don't get taught the specifics. A lot of it is just what you were saying about imitation.
Yes.
And yet I find people have, for instance, a huge presentation, you know, that's next Tuesday.
Mm.
You know, they don't have 5 years of doing some sort of class where you walk on stage.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've had to, in my world, say, what is it that you do? Right, do this. This is where your eyes go. This is where your body goes. This is where your hands go. This is where your, you know, direction you face. This is what your arms do.
Yes.
And to help people get a new pattern that's a positive performance pattern.
Yes.
You know, people will walk short when they get on stage, which is a stress thing, and also their arms will stick by their side. So consciously, do you ever think of those things?
That is how I know that I'm comfortable, because I move my hands a lot
when
I speak, only when I'm comfortable. But I found a lot of the time I'd keep my hands here, and then as sort of, that was why if I did a 3-minute song, I was like, no, I didn't have time to calm down, it's already over. But giving a keynote speech or something, I'd walk out like this, like, oh my God. And then you'd just be like, oh, I'm moving a hand. We're getting there. But it is being aware of these things that an audience picks up on. If you are like this, they can kind of see, oh, they don't want to be up there, they're not confident.
I love that, what you did with your hands. You know, hands guide airflow.
Mm.
And so singers know that hands guide airflow. And you will, you know, I find that people who don't understand this, they'll go, bah, bah, black sheep, have you any wool? Well, what's the hand doing there? You know, it's bah, bah, black sheep, have you any wool?
Yes.
The hand goes to the end of the phrase. Very important in singing.
Definitely. I think it gives conviction to what you're saying. And when you're at ease, your audience is at ease. And I can imagine that you would come across a lot of people who've probably had really bad experiences in their childhood, in school. We're not really taught how to manage this speaking in front of people anxiety. I felt it in school. You would never guess that.
You bet. Performance anxiety, I think the statistic says 4% of people have performance anxiety.
Oh no.
Not my experience.
No.
It's every second person. And people who, I've had performance anxiety since the youngest age of five, and, you know, I work with it all the time with myself and help others. And if you haven't had it, you don't get it. You know, you don't get how paralyzing an experience can be.
Absolutely.
And it's always, you know, you said you went up and then you came down again. And you have to realize that that will happen and accept that, move on, take the next step. And, you know, I always say being professional is, of course, you have good days, you have bad days.
Yes.
But you have good, bad days that never go below a certain line of professionalism, which means you have to know what you're doing. So if you were doing a Marilyn Monroe, how would you stand? Would you like to stand up?
Sure.
So let's stand up. So if you were Marilyn Monroe right now, how would you stand and face the camera?
Okay, so Marilyn, I find, I personally am a little bit arch. She's very pronounced. So first thing I always do is chest up, elbows back is my first one.
Right.
And then I find with her, she's very hippie. So it's always sort of sunk into one hip, or what we say is a beveled knee. So I'm always on my toes. See, so it's quite sexy, but relaxed. And I find she tends to, instead of having her arms down, she actually has her arms up here a lot of the time. It's always like very feminine by the arm. So yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yes, you already look like her. You played it perfectly.
And then if you were, you played a gangster, what would you do if you were the gangster?
Very grounded.
Yep.
So the gangster that I created the character of was based off Marilyn. So she's still very sexy. So I found it's a similar stance. However, it's a lot more grounded because you want to be scary. The feet are a bit more apart. You're sort of strong-shouldered, a little bit more intimidating. So your head tends to be down looking this way a lot as opposed to Marilyn's very submissive.
Right.
Yeah, so it's a lot more of a stronger stance.
And what position would you take as you're walking in and you're the rock star and everybody wants to see you when you walk?
For me personally, I still am quite, I think I would say, demure in my approach. In Malaysia, it's still very not boisterous and loud.
Right.
So, but when you walk in, you're still prepared.
Right.
You know that you're going to be the center of attention from a, in a, and I would say not in a sort of full of yourself kind of way, but you know, okay, it's photo time, you're ready. So it is, I would be walking up to the door like, okay, it's time to be on, and when you switch on, up, ready, and it's like, oh, hey, you're relaxed, but you're open. So you're inviting people in to speak to you, whereas I personally, when I'm at other social events, you'll find I'm quite, I tend to be very anxious and shy, so it is turning on.
Yeah, great.
Ready. Approach me. Yeah, come. Ask me for a photo.
Trust.
Yeah, exactly. Because you know people are going to want to come up to you. So if you're like this, yep, they're not going to approach you.
I love it when the Americans walk on stage and they point people out.
Yeah. Yep. They've got their
hand in their trunk. Works. Yeah. And then if you're a magician's assistant,
yes,
what do you do?
It's more a present. So it's up and out. It's very, my hat will fall off. But I remember everything was this way. It's dramatic. It's open. Everything's very big.
And how do you stand if you don't want to attract attention? So the magician's doing their trick.
Yes.
You've got to stand and face. What do you do?
It is just very still. We say not pulling focus. So right, there would be a lot of the times they'd be doing their trick. You'd hit your position.
Yep.
And you would be still, not moving. That's one thing I think that you don't realize you learn it as you learn performing, but you tend to learn very quickly. It's not your moment.
Yeah.
So don't pull focus. Hmm. So it was always like, stay still, don't be looking around. Because if you're looking around while they're doing their trick, it's going to pull someone's eye to you, going, oh, what are they doing over there?
Yeah, so group presentations, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
People have no idea, you know, in opera, if you're singing with somebody, say a tenor, and they do a dumb note. The key thing is you can't look to the camera and go, what was that? You know? you have to still look at them
exactly,
like they're gone and go, oh my God. You know, and people save it up and they look, yes, and then they come off stage and go, what was that? You know,
yes,
like they can't do it here, can't do it here.
Exactly.
And
the show must go on.
Yeah. And so, you know, you're here, but what when you want to attract attention? How would you suddenly bring it back to you when they've done their trick and now it's back to you?
You just have to show command. So a lot of times, say, if we even do speaking events or we do performances, or sometimes I like to do my performances where I let my band have their moment and I'll go actually get out of their way off the stage and stand to the side, and
right,
people can tell I'm watching them.
Right.
So if I'm watching them and I'm giving them the respect of showing what they're doing, your body language is different. You know, just very contained. You know, even if you've got to talk to someone, as soon as it's your time again, you're back on, you're back up, and you're asking for attention. So I know, like, I'll be like, oh my God, weren't they amazing? Thank you so much. You become a lot more expressive and you're owning the space you stand on.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think
you've just got
to analyze that part of it.
Yeah, you've just got to have
that light and shade, I guess.
Mm. I'd say that you look at people as though they're God when they're speaking. Right. And then you can look out, but it's only to guide people back. So it's like, wow, look at me. Wow, look at that. You know, wow. And like you say, weren't they amazing, you know?
I found that with emceeing and TV presenting, actually, especially even when they're talking and you've given the floor to someone else, you want to engage the audience to be listening to them. Isn't it a funny thing? I'm sure you've observed it many times. Great TV presenters have that gift where if this person's talking, I can still look at you and make sure you're still engaged and look back at the person without stealing their thunder.
I love that in TV because blank space is hopeless. And so they're a lot closer than, you know, in these COVID times. They're a lot closer, but they're looking out there and then going, isn't that fabulous? You don't even notice when you're watching it, but to do it is really quite different.
It is, and it's very confronting. It is very confronting because these people are in your personal space. But as soon as when you're giving any kind of presentation, a singer, or anything, people can read when you go. So that is a skill that can be learned, though, to be like, okay, it's safe here. I think that's the thing, is learning where you feel safe as a performer.
Yeah. Spatial awareness is fascinating.
Yes.
So, you know, I noticed that you're quite often like side on, and then, you know, that kind of, because you're doing that kind of Marilyn, it's not confrontational.
Yes.
She's a very side on kind of figure,
yes,
as opposed to front on. And when you said about the gangster, you said the feet are further apart,
yes,
and you actually turn front on, and then altered the head look, so it comes down like that. It's interesting. People aren't aware. I had a lady who was chair of the board, and she said, "I'm very intimidating." And I said, "Let me have a look at you." And she looked like this, you know, like, "Hello, I'm Anakin." You know, she was looking through these eyes.
Yes.
And that's what the Joker does. Mm. And that's what, you know, evil characters do. When they play evil characters, is the and you see the whites under the ball of the eye, which is really evil. So it's more front on, more confrontational, side on. You know, this positional awareness, spatial awareness on stage, of when, no doubt, you know, you come in and you take a little bit more of the stage. Would that be right?
I believe so, and I think I've noticed, and please, you're the expert on this, that there's a lot less movement in someone who's intimidating. Like, they tend to be strong and still. Whereas the difference in Marilyn is she's always moving. She's always light and easily, like, moving at any time. Should I need to flee? You know, I'm so funny, sort of thing. Whereas any super, even people I know that are super intimidating, they command and they're a lot more still and steady on their ground. So I try to use that when I act or when I do something else, because I'm naturally very all over the place. But is that what you found too? Is that some, maybe that's why that woman was so intimidating? She was strong and...
It's the use of movement. I call it movement followed by static, which is used in movies a lot. And one of the things that I've found people do, Zoolander, is whenever he goes to make a photo to relax himself, you know, he'll always turn and then freeze. And it's movement followed by static. And it works really well to attract attention. And what many people who are untrained do is they do static followed by movement. So they'll go, "Are we ready? Are we ready?" And then they go, "Hi, everyone." You know, it's kind of not wrong. And I was watching Joanna Lumley in one of her documentaries, and she was filming a scene in India, and she's going, "Are we ready? Are we ready?" And then she'd go, you know, in India, and she turned. And they took about 5 takes, and she did the same thing every time.
Yes.
And getting people to loosen up what they do by not just standing and staring, but actually having movement and knowing when to move, when not to move.
That actually, I didn't realize that we do it. But a couple of co-stars that I have when we have hosted things, we actually laugh first and then we start the talking. So it's already like in motion. I didn't actually realize we did it until now. I like something new.
Laughter is a bouncing of the diaphragm, and that's just what you want, which is why it's always great to come on stage and then to do something that gets the audience laughing, because air moves, there's communication, bodies release, you know.
Right.
Yeah, laughter is just a bouncing diaphragm.
Oh, so that movement, like, I'm going to remember that now. I'm going to try the turn next time.
That's it. And let's sit down. You know what I notice is that when you're speaking and you laugh, your mouth opens, like, like, no problem, that mouth opening.
Yes.
And I've got this rule of thumb, which actually involves 2 fingers, where I say, just check if your mouth's open. 2 fingers, see, in your mouth, 3 fingers open.
3 to 4, yes, definitely.
People find it very difficult to open their mouth. Is it important to open your mouth, do you think?
I believe so. I find it's very natural for me, and I have been criticised about this.
It's natural for everyone. You know, it's just habitual that you keep it open, or habitual that people shut it.
Is
like, all babies are born opening and closing their mouth, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. Why are you being criticised?
Well, I tend to laugh very heartily, and I nervous laugh a lot, and it is very big. Ha, 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 you know, and I've got quite a cackle when you get
Why would anybody criticise that?
In Malaysia, it was quite a shock to me, because I do find that people find, I think, my nervousness a little bit endearing over there, and they will, my laugh will make them laugh, and it kind of breaks the ice a little bit. But I was working with my record label over there, and they were like, "Cassidy, you're not allowed to laugh. People are laughing at you, not with you." And I was very shocked, and it made me very self-conscious of this. For a while there, I was laughing, covering my mouth.
Okay. Never a good look.
Yeah. But
psychologically.
Yeah. Eventually, I was just like, it is what it is. Ha, ha, ha.
That's right. Great. I love it.
Let it go.
Let it go. They will will not tie me down.
They will not stop the love.
There are a lot of standards in culture which do block us down, and especially as women. Just lockdown. And you often get asked to play, you know, that kind of woman who's not intimidating, or, you know, the Marilyn sort of character. Would you like to play another character?
For me, I found it very empowering to play a strong gangster female, because it is so opposite to what I've had to be for many years, because it is quite a submissive female role in Malay culture, especially the section that I'm in, and people did not respond well to me being open and loud and laughing. And so I didn't realize I was doing it, but I did lose myself for the few years that I lived there. I became very apologetic for myself, and my way I stood, my way I spoke changed, and sort of playing a strong character reminded me of who I sort of was before I went on that journey. So for me, that was actually my dream role. For playing submissive for me would have just been like, I'm not acting, I'm just being myself. You know, I would still absolutely love to attempt something even crazier. I think that would be really freeing. I've done some green screen videos recently for my music videos, because it's COVID times, we've got to adapt. Yep. And I did two videos for Halloween. One was a retro version of Thriller, and I played all these different, like, Western ghosts and ghouls and things, and got into quite a crazy headspace. And then I did four Malay ghosts in one the next week. And these were all really sinister characters, and I really quite enjoyed it.
Mm.
So it was very out of body for me to try and get into this space of movement.
So these 9.5 million fans, what are they going to see next?
Oh, I have taken a year off from performing since COVID hit. I jumped on a plane and I didn't realize what was ahead of me. So moving back to Australia was such a massive life change, and I'm going down a very different path. I've found a very different style of music that I sing. I've really rediscovered myself, and I've actually had to overcome a lot of trauma from being away and being famous, that you don't sort of understand a part of parcel of fame. Things that you go through. Sorry, my hat's
falling off. That's fascinating.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's definitely been a transition period for me. So I plan on making some English music now.
Yeah,
I've been singing in Chinese and French and things, but moving forward, I will be walking a very different path.
That's kind of changing your identity.
100%.
And, you know, people do change their identity because they leave a job, they go to a different job, they, you know, their life changes in some way. And it's very hard.
Mm.
It's very hard. It's like people leaving the army, you know, and it's harder than you think to get into a different identity. Myself, I was in opera.
Yes.
And when you sing opera, people are fascinated by everything that you do. And suddenly I said, I'm not singing anymore. And then nobody's interested. And it was a huge change. And I can think being famous in Malaysia and then suddenly what am I doing in Melbourne, Australia? And that's very hard.
Yes, and it is a total, you're right, it's a change of identity.
Mm.
And at some point I had believed the only way what I did was of value was by singing in that language,
right,
especially
right.
in Malay. Like, that's where my big response comes from, and I've got such a beautiful following, but that's only one part of what I do. And I had allowed myself to buy into the idea that that was the only worth I had, being the token foreign girl that speaks their language.
Right.
And then moving back here, people have reawakened my faith in myself.
Oh,
that I have something to offer the Australian industry. So.
Wow. Mm-hmm. The fascinated by COVID. It's been for COVID, many people
yes.
have thought about what am I doing?
Yes.
You know, what am I doing? Who is the real me? Who do I want to be?
Yes.
And you've gone down this path of, you know, the Marilyn Monroe and molding into that and then thinking, but that's not all I am. So
yeah.
coming back here was a chance to go, okay, who is that more? And now you've got some different music that you've enjoyed.
I do. The harsh, I think, reality about social media and building a presence online, you might have all these people who are interested in certain videos, but they've got no interest in other things. So as much as I absolutely love my Malaysian career and singing in Malay...
You won't go back to that?
I'll go back and do shows or act in something and fly over there for that periodically, but I will never move back again.
Oh, you won't?
No, because it's not good for my own mental health.
Right.
If that makes sense. I don't have a family support system over there. I don't have a team over there. I have one assistant who I absolutely adore, but that's it. I'm alone. You know what I mean? It's a very lonely place to be. So as much as my career there is amazing and I would love to continue it where I can, it doesn't fulfill me as a person. Fame doesn't fulfill a person like...
It's hard to give up.
Very hard to give up. Yeah.
Did you live in a beautiful apartment?
I had a gorgeous big studio apartment with a big chandelier, and it was not a safe, I guess, place to live as a solo female in Malaysia.
Right. Wow.
So I realized I was on fight or flight mode 24/7 for 3 years.
Right.
So it's, as much as it's an amazing life to live, I think it's better to live it for a month here and a month there, as opposed to living there full time.
You know, I read something once about a woman going to her car in a car park, and they said, you know, she'll check her handbag, check that it's zipped, check that she can run with the shoes, check the floor, check that she's got her keys in her hand with the key pointing out, have a look around at what's there, check the lighting, see if there are other people, check out, you know, blah, 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 and then get in the car, lock the doors, drive, and they say, what does a man do when he goes to the car park, walk to the car and get in?
Exactly. There were situations in Malaysia where, fortunately, I have always been very cued on to energies and body language, and I can understand when someone's not in their right mind, when someone's probably dangerous. And I had a couple of situations where, had I not been aware, I would have been abducted, I would have been kidnapped in Malaysia. So it creates you to be hyper vigilant 24/7, and unless I'm able to go there and travel and be in a safer situation with a full-time family member traveling or something, I wouldn't do it again.
See, it's like I'm thinking of Princess Diana.
Yeah.
And people don't realise
yeah.
that, you know, when she got a divorce, she lost her security and she was just hurt,
yeah.
you know. And you are famous, but you
yeah.
don't have people looking after you.
No. Who's got $2,500 a day to have a full-time security team? Like, it's very expensive to have those little things that people assume comes with the job, but it's not always so.
Do you think you can keep up the contacts globally in two different countries?
Yes, I definitely think so. It's just a question of, I think now my focus is doing things that fulfill me as opposed to fulfilling other people's needs. So I have been very fortunate there to fulfill pretty much all of the greatest honours you can have in that country.
Right.
And so I feel like that chapter is quite complete.
Right. Okay.
And now I've been actually writing a book at the moment about my experiences there and how I got to that point. But now I'm really interested in understanding
why. Have you got a title?
I do.
What is it?
It's called How to Be a Woman of Influence, a Cautionary Tale.
A cautionary tale.
Yes. So it is. It's all about how we as performers or anyone, these days everyone with social media, we are raised to desire fame and notoriety and, you know, however many followers. But we don't understand what we're chasing and why or the reality of it.
How many followers do you have?
Collectively, I have over 400,000. Across my platforms, last I checked.
Did I read what Cassie was reading at the moment? You know, like,
Yeah, exactly. You share your entire life online. And I've been very fortunate to be able to sort of separate my life a lot and keep a lot for myself, but actually getting the followers and things, as beautiful as it is, it will change your life exponentially. And that's why so many people like Tones and I and Sia and all these Australian people have reached much more fame than I ever have, and they don't want it. They want to just create the art they love.
Right.
Yeah.
Create the art you love.
Yeah.
Go forth doing that.
Yeah, you've got to sacrifice these views. And that's like the views I do now. The things I've been creating this year are for my own fulfillment, and they get like a hundredth of the views, but I'm proud of them. And it was because I feel compelled to do it, not because someone else is saying, do this, it'll get views.
Cassie, where do people get in contact with you or follow you?
Yeah.
How do they do that?
They can find me online anywhere at Cassie La Creme. Yeah.
Cassie La Creme with C-A-S-S-E-Y.
C-A-S-S-I-D-Y.
Oh, Cassie D.
Yes.
But, yeah, right.
Yes.
Right.
Sorry. Yes, Cassie La Creme. Anywhere they'll be able to find me. All the same. Pretty easy to spot on there.
You're very easy to find online. Very easy to find.
Thank you.
Fabulous talking to you.
It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. I've learned so much from it as well. I'm fascinated to continue to see what you create. And this is amazing that you are sharing this information with people.
Thank you. We'll keep talking.
Yes.
There's Louise. Thanks for listening. Never miss an episode by subscribing to the Pop Podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Are you a keynote speaker? Need executive coaching or voice training? Contact Louise at louisemahler.com.au.